Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Just when you thought you heard it all, but you haven't heard this. Ludwig Minelli, speaking to the BBC in Great Britain, said that suicide is a marvelous, marvelous human possibility. In light of the fact that, so many things cost so much, and in light of the fact that human beings evidently are free to set our own destiny, in light of the fact that he evidently thinks death is a wonderful thing, Ludwig Minelli, the founder of Dignitas in Switzerland, was in Great Britain to promote the idea of assisted suicide, euthanasia, what they call their assisted death. And when he was talking to the BBC, he was amazingly candid. Let's just hear it in his own voice. You'll hear exactly what we're talking about here. This is Ludwig Minelli speaking to the BBC in London.
Is what you would ultimately like the right to have assisted suicide, no matter who you are, whether you're seriously ill or not?
Is without condition. A right, a human right, is without any condition, except capacity of discernment. I have a totally different attitude to suicide. I say suicide is a marvelous possibility given to a human being.
Well, that was a little long, but what you heard there was it was a marvelous possibility given to a human being. Talking about suicide there. Bonnie Urbay, you might know her from NPR, National Public Radio. She is also a columnist at U.S. News and World Report. She's out making the same argument. You had Ludwig Minelli making the argument that the economic pressure should lead some person to commit suicide. It's a rational act, a marvelous possibility. But then you have Bonnie Urbay writing at U.S. News and World Report yesterday suggesting that abortion would be a rational decision, a beneficial decision, in light of the economic consequences. Some would call it a tragedy, she said. I don't believe it is a tragedy at all. We'll be watching what she has to say. We'll be talking about this idea that the culture of death is not going to show its face in light of the economic crisis. It's pretty sharp stuff. In light of the fact that we're now facing this economic downturn, there's some people who are saying, let's just let some people die. The old, the terminally ill, the unborn. You know, the culture of death generally hides its face better than this. What we're looking at here is a very cold, straightforward, unvarnished, absolutely in-your-face presentation of the rationality, indeed the beneficial aspects of suicide and abortion. We're going to be talking about the culture of death showing its face in light of this economic downturn. We're going to talk about how insidious and evil it is to suggest to persons that it is rational in light of economic pressure that they themselves or someone else will be better off dead. Or that society, and that's the interesting point made by both of these individuals, that society will be better off with at least some people dead. We're going to talk about this today on the Albert Mohler Program. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You'll find an article at my website at albertmohler.com entitled Marvelous Suicide and Beneficial Abortion. Worldviews matter. And boy, they do. Perhaps never more graphically seen than in these two articles that you will find as links in my article at albertmohler.com. We're going to get to that discussion in just a moment. First, a review of some issues in the news. From the Economist of London comes a very interesting report from Berlin. It turns out that in most of Germany, there is official religious teaching going on in the schools. But in the area of Berlin, this has not been true for some time. But now there are serious proposals to bring religious education into the state schools there in Berlin. The complicating factors are two. First of all, Berlin is described by some people as, quote, the world capital of atheism. Get this, and this was shocking to me. 60% of Berliners profess no religion. As The Economist reports, this is a tendency stronger in the ex-communist East than in the bourgeois West. But what you're looking at here is the first complication being, how do you teach religion in the public schools when 60% of the people of Berlin profess no religion at all? Here's the second complicating factor, and this also will surprise some people. I'm reading here from this report in The Economist from Berlin. Listen to this paragraph. What everyone shares is an obsession with Muslims, who account for over half the students in parts of the city. End quote. Now, time and time again, we come back to the challenge of Islam being the challenge of the 21st century. In some ways, you could say the challenge is secularism, but secularism creates a vacuum that never lasts. Behind secularism is going to come something else, and in much of Western Europe, that something else is already known to us. It is Islam. Now, let me just repeat what I said a moment ago. I'm reading here from the article. The article says that 60% of Berliners profess no religion. Keep that as statistic number one. The second statistic in the same article, over half of the students in some parts of Berlin are Muslims. That doesn't leave much room for Christians in Berlin, Germany. It tells you something about the way of Europe, and it tells you something about what happens when a society turns into a secularized civilization. It doesn't last. Secularization is like a vacuum, and as you know, as a law of physics, nature abhors a vacuum. Something will go in and will fill where the vacuum had once been, and that something, it turns out, is going to be Islam. As you're watching American popular culture, you're going to be watching tonight, because tonight is the last episode of ER, one of the longest-running dramas in American television history. It debuted in 1994, and back then, there were three major networks who ruled television: NBC, CBS, and ABC. And even as James Poholowicz is now reporting in Time magazine, you're now looking at the demise of ER, also indicating the demise in many ways of the audience for network television. Now get this. In 1952-53, 75% of Americans every night were watching ABC, CBS, and NBC. By 1982, that 75% had shrunk to 51%, and as of 2007-2008, it is only 18%. Now, one of the very interesting things reported in this Time magazine article is the fact that what is migrating now to the broadcast television channels, in particular to the network programming, are talk shows. And thus, you're not going to have the kind of serious dramas that had once marked primetime television on the networks, found on the networks much longer. Instead, they're going to gravitate towards pay television. This is the way the article ends. It says, no doubt TV is changing and fast. Free TV will become more cut rate. Quality will cost, as books and movies do. There will be more rarefied TV and more, I won't use the word it says there, more inferior stuff, let's just put it that way. There will be less middle-of-the-road TV for everybody, but more venues for telling stories that don't have to please 30 million people, end quote. Now, that's the interesting point to me. If you are really back in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, 80s, even into the 90s when ER started in 1994, if you are trying to reach the American public, you've got to reach it through those networks, and you've got to reach a very broad spectrum. But nowadays, television audiences are niche audiences by definition, and that explains why you're seeing so much stuff on television that makes you scratch your head and wonder, who's actually watching that? Well, it turns out it's not 75% of the American population. It's not 55, 56, 51, 37, 22, or even 18% anymore. It is a declining number. A lot of Americans, nonetheless, will be watching tonight for the final episode of ER. And the word is that one of the original stars, George Clooney, is going to be making a return visit, which evidently makes for big ratings anticipated for the last episode of ER. A lot of people point to Cuba as some kind of workers' paradise. The reality is quite different on the ground. But there's one particular angle that has my interest today. Blake Hurst, a farmer and writer from Missouri, is writing about the fact that there are so many people who are now pointing to Cuba, especially those who are kind of advocates of a green revolution, as a model of sustainable agriculture. And they point out that many American authors, including people like Bill McKibben, who frankly writes some fascinating stuff that interests me, and Paul Roberts, who's the author of the 2008 book The End of Food, as these authors and others are promoting Cuba in this case, as a model of sustainable agriculture, they tend to leave out one item, and this is a rather stunning item. Cuba has to import 84% of its food. So here's the bottom line. Evidently, it's pretty easy to have boutique farms if you don't have to feed anybody. But it's just a reminder to us that in these issues, as in so many others, people who would suggest that we need to fundamentally change our agriculture had better take into account that we also have to feed people at the same time. And America is often referred to as the breadbasket of the world. We now share that with some other countries. But the reality is that there are millions and millions of people to feed, and for good reason. And it's going to be interesting to see how some of these things turn out. But it's a reminder to me that when you read some of these books about all of these wonderful models, there may actually be a model there, and it might be transportable, and that model actually might be transferable to a very large-scale project. On the other hand, if Cuba has to import 84% of its food, it's hardly a model of anything that could be called sustainable. Back to talk about economic pressure showing the culture of death at its worst, which means the culture of death at its most honest. You're listening to the Albert Miller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Moeller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. Usually the culture of death hides itself behind a mask. I mean, that's generally true. This kind of anti-human, godless ideology generally disguises itself or presents itself in a cloud of euphemisms, you know, words that are indirect, that do not reveal in their ugliness exactly what's being talked about. Or it hides itself behind all kinds of sophisticated arguments and indirectness so that by innuendo and inference you supposedly get the point that the culture of death is beginning to undermine human dignity. Rarely do you have it so straightforward as what we had yesterday, just in one day. And of all things, it was April the 1st, but this is no April Fool's. In one day, two very serious articles by two very serious people, in the one case, an interview with the BBC, and another, an article at U.S. News and World Report, made arguments that are absolutely chilling in their straightforward, honest, unvarnished presentation of the logic of the culture of death. Both of them, interestingly, began with the economic turmoil as the foundation for the argument. In other words, we now found ourselves in a very difficult financial situation. We're looking at what might be called the Great Recession, or whatever you want to call it. And obviously, there are financial pressures upon families, communities, entire nations and economies. Let me just take these in turn. First of all, the BBC granted an interview to Ludwig Minnelli. Ludwig Minnelli is rather famous in Europe. He is a Swiss-based organizer for assisted suicide. He is the director of Dignitas, which is a Swiss-based organization that actually offers assisted suicide. According to media reports in Great Britain, Dignitas has already assisted at least 100 British citizens to commit suicide. Assisted suicide is illegal in Great Britain, so what they do now is they have suicide tourism so that people go to Switzerland in order to end their lives. It had been several years since Mr. Minnelli had given an interview to the BBC, but he gave an interview just in the last few days that was broadcast yesterday, and it's just unbelievable. He said things that, so far as I know, no advocate of assisted suicide has yet said, and he said them in the authoritative context of an interview with the BBC. Speaking with the BBC, Mr. Minnelli said that assisted suicide should become recognized as a fundamental human right. He said, without conditions. There should be no conditions on it, just as there are no conditions on what he implied was the right to breathe or the right of free speech or anything else that's understood as what it means to be human. Criticizing resistance to the idea of suicide, he said, quote, I have a totally different attitude to suicide. I say suicide is a marvelous, marvelous possibility given to a human being. Ending his gushing advocacy of killing oneself, he added, quote, suicide is a very good possibility to escape a situation which you can't alter, end quote. Now, interestingly, Minnelli makes an economic argument in pressing his enthusiastic support for suicide. Let me just read to you from what he said in the interview. He said, for 50 suicide attempts, you have one suicide, and the others are failing with heavy costs on the National Health Service. If we would have another attitude to suicide, saying suicide is a very good possibility to escape, in many, many cases, they are terribly hurt afterwards. Sometimes you have to put them in institutions for 50 years, period. Very costly, period. Unbelievable. He's saying, look, we can't afford all these people just trying suicide. He says, for every 50 people who attempt suicide, you end up with 49 people who end up being a medical cost because they don't actually commit suicide. You need to assist them so that they are successful in committing suicide. It saves money. Mr. Minnelli also makes clear, by the way, in the interview, that he does not believe that suicide is a marvelous possibility only for the terminally ill. Now get this, he and his organization have actually helped psychiatric patients to commit suicide. Now just imagine this, you have someone who's suicidal, you take him to the medical clinic, and there they are helped by someone who says, you are an amateur, we'll show you how to do it. And that's exactly what's going on. You'll be hearing that in his own voice in just a moment. He told the BBC also of a Canadian couple planning a joint suicide. The husband is ill, the wife is not, but the wife has indicated she just wants to, quote, go at the same time, end quote. Minnelli complained that Swiss law, though notoriously ambiguous on such matters, might present a problem if Dignitas helped the wife to commit suicide. Now let's just take Mr. Minnelli and his argument on its own terms for just a moment. Again, I want you to hear it in his own voice. This is a rather long clip, and he's speaking with a Swiss accent, but you really need to hear again what he says in his own voice.
Is what you would ultimately like the right to have assisted suicide, no matter who you are, whether you're seriously ill or not?
Is without condition. A right, a human right, is without any condition, except capacity of discernment. I have a totally different attitude to suicide. I say suicide is a marvelous possibility given to a human being.
A marvelous possibility given to a human being. Okay, I want you to hear what he says again in his own voice, his own words, when he talks about helping mental health patients to commit suicide.
You have carried out assisted suicides of,
yes,
mental health patients, haven't you?
Yes, we have, of course.
Of course. Very straightforward. In all that I have read and heard by proponents of assisted suicide, I'll tell you, as I talk to you today, I've never heard anything quite so straightforward. Coming from someone that can speak with such authority, given his own role in the assisted suicide debate and in the practice of assisted suicide, and given the fact that he's not talking here to some kind of fringe media outlet, he's speaking to the British Broadcasting Corporation, and he's speaking in light of the fact that the British government is taking up the issue right now. Now, that's Great Britain. It's across an ocean. But let us just remember that on November the 4th of this year, the citizens of the state of Washington, D.C. voted to authorize and legalize assisted suicide in that state. To its south, 10 years previous, the state of Oregon had voted to do the same thing, and there are proposals before state legislatures recurringly in the other 48 states to follow that example. We're talking about the way that the culture of death is now showing itself behind the arguments made on economic terms in terms of this economic turmoil and transformation that we are experiencing. No doubt there are economic pressures that are unprecedented. Those have the attention of Bonnie Urbe of NPR. She is also a columnist at U.S. News and World Report. And writing in her column at U.S. News and World Report, she argues, let me just show you how she begins her article. She says, the recession is driving American demand for contraception and for abortions. The media have been rife this past week with stories about the rising number of couples and single mothers doing the math and deciding this is no time to bring a child into the world, not when the economy is depressed, jobs are scarce, and family incomes are dropping. End quote. She then proceeds to complain that many media reports treat these abortions as a tragedy. It is not, she retorts. Before I interject some other thoughts, let me just to continue to tell what she writes here. She relates the story of a woman in Oakland, California, who aborted what would have been her fourth child. It was a desired pregnancy. The woman cried, according to the Associated Press, as she told the physician why she was seeking the abortion. But in her own chilling words, Bonnie Urbe said, yes, it's sad that this unwed pregnant mother of three had no money for bus fare. It's terrible. Her boyfriend lost his job. It's heart-wrenching that she fell to tears in the doctor's office. But in the long run, can we not agree that an unwed couple's decision not to bring a fourth child into the world when they're having trouble feeding themselves and three children is no tragedy? Can we agree the abortion is no tragedy? That's what she wants us to agree. I want to know what you're thinking about this. There's a lot more coming, both from Mr. Minnelli and from Ms. Bonnie Urbe. When we come back, give me a call at 877-893-8255. We better speak to this and fast. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, when you look at these reports in particular, you look at these two media actualities here. We're talking, first of all, about the interview with Ludwig Minnelli with the BBC, and then the column by Bonnie Urbay at U.S. News and World Report. We're looking at arguments that most people would find almost unbelievable. Ludwig Minnelli, the founder of Dignitas, writing that suicide should be seen as a marvelous human possibility, even extended to mental health patients and all the rest. And again, making an economic argument, which, let's just face it, is the argument we'll all be better off if certain people are dead. That's the argument. He points to the costs that come to the National Health Service when people do not commit suicide. And he says we need to help with that. Then you have Bonnie Urbay here in the United States. She is also, by the way, the host of the PBS program To the Contrary. And she is arguing that we should see abortion as basically a good. She asked in the section of her essay that I read just before we went into the break, she says, can we not agree that an unwed couple's decision not to bring a fourth child into the world when they're having trouble feeding themselves and their three children is no tragedy? And the background of that is a woman who had an abortion because she said she and her family could not support another mouth to feed. She says, that's just, well, let me just use her words. She says, it's actually a fact-based, rational decision that in the end benefits the three children they already have and society as well. So, here you had Ludwig Minnelli, who calls suicide a wonderful human possibility. And now you have Bonnie Urbay, who calls abortion, in this case, a fact-based, rational decision that is supposedly justified by benefits to the family and society. She goes on, she says, it's no tragedy, it's a good decision. She says that the economic argument should prevail here, insisting that the abortion, quote, lessens the chance the family will have to rely on scarce public resources, end quote. So there it is, the logic of the culture of death with the logic of economic recession. You put the two together, and you end up with people saying, we'll be better off if other people are dead, if certain other people just don't exist, whether they are the terminally ill or whatever, whoever's inclined toward suicide, let them commit suicide, we won't have to worry about them. And then the unborn, well, they are vulnerable too, because they're going to have to justify their existence economically. By the way, I want to go back to something that is at the very top of Bonnie Urbay's article. And she talks about abortion being a rational decision, quote, when the economy is depressed, jobs are scarce, and family incomes are dropping, end quote. Let me just point out, I don't want to underestimate the scale of this economic recession. I don't want to underestimate the fact that there are many people who are now jobless. There are families who are finding their entire financial situation turned upside down. But are we really going to make the historical argument that these are the worst times in human history, and that all of a sudden humanity is now facing a new crisis that should bring into question whether we should even bring the next generation into existence? We're not talking about the Dark Ages here. We're not talking about the plague years. We're not talking about the Hundred Years' War. You know, we're not talking about a pogrom or genocide here that is going on, that a cataclysmic war like World War II. What are we talking about? We're talking about an economic downturn, yes, with consequences, yes, with suffering, yes, with challenges, absolutely. But what kind of audacity leads us to say the morality of humanity is now changed so that suicide and abortion now should be understood as rational, perhaps even moral goods? Give me a call at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. I want to tell you, if you have not heard this argument before, you've heard it now. And I think there's no coincidence that at this point we're now having arguments like these made, because there are people who are pushing their own agendas. And whether the agenda is that of assisted suicide or euthanasia on the one hand, or abortion on the other hand, there are people who believe that the way to solve the human problem is for there to be less humans. Evidently, whatever the means of arriving at less humans, fewer humans. And this, to me, is something that requires an answer. How are you going to answer someone who says, look at the economy? If you look at the economy, suicide and abortion become rational decisions, fact-based rational decisions. You know, one of the things I mentioned during the introductory segment yesterday is this article by Baroness Finley in which she opposed assisted suicide, and she pointed out as a physician, she said, you know, when a patient asks me, should I consider assisted suicide? She said, the moment I begin to accept it as an option, I'm implying that they should. They hear whatever I say as an indication that maybe they'd be better off dead. You know, I think there are clearly now people in the society who would very intentionally, strategically send that signal to pregnant moms and to those who might be in a vulnerable situation considering suicide. Give me a call. Give me an answer at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. You're listening to the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mueller Program. Some are using the context of this economic recession to argue that society would be better off if some people weren't here. Lou Vigminelli, arguing with the BBC, at the interview process with the BBC, goes on and says, look, I think suicide should be recognized as a fundamental human right, a wonderful human possibility. Bonnie Urbay of PBS and also of U.S. News and World Report, writing at the magazine, says, we should see people making decisions to have abortions during this time of economic recession to be rational, a good decision. It just makes sense, economic sense. I want to know what you think about this. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Louisville, Kentucky. Amanda is listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Amanda.
Yes, hi. Thank you for having me on the program, first of all. And I'm a financial advisor here in Louisville, Kentucky. And just to hear the argument that abortion makes good sense in a recession because of the scarcity of public resources, you're treating a human life like it's a commodity. I mean, you're saying that in times of a recession, sure, we're going to sell this and buy this because this might perform better out of a recession. But to use that as an argument for abortion, you're treating it like a commodity.
Amanda, that's a very keen moral insight, and that's exactly the right word to use. And we should note that we have been observing the commodification of human dignity over the last several years in some very specific ways. For instance, the economic argument was used, cited by President Barack Obama when he announced the new policy on human embryonic stem cell experimentation. The logic comes back again. William Salatin at Slate.com makes this so clear. The logic comes down to the fact that the embryos exist, and it would thus be a waste, an economic waste, not to use them. The same argument I pointed out at my website at albertmueller.com in an article that was published entitled The Fetus is Organ Factory. You know, the same argument was used just in the last few weeks at Oxford University, of all places, by a professor who said, look, we should use tissues and organs taken from human fetuses because, again, to fail to use them would be uneconomical. It would be economic waste. That's the commodification of human beings. We say that humanity is worth X. These embryonic stem cells are worth X. The human embryo is worth Y. It is literally the commodification. And here, Amanda's exactly right. We stack up the cost on one side, the cost of a human being, and on the other side, the savings that would come if that human being did not exist. Marx, as in Karl Marx, would recognize that as commodification. It is the translation of something that is not economic into something that is measured in economic terms. Thanks for your call, Amanda. Let's go to Claire calling from Pennsylvania. What do you think, Claire?
Hey, Dr. Mueller. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to tie in your I guess, incredulity with this boldness with something you said earlier. I think you mentioned that it was Germany where 60% of the people profess no belief in any kind of religion, is
yeah,
that right?
It was the city of Berlin in particular, yes.
Okay, in the city of Berlin. Well, then why would we be surprised if people with no theistic basis for valuing human life would therefore say, you know, why not take it? If you don't have any reason to value human life, if you know, you're a pure humanist, you get into the, what, utilitarianism of Peter Singer or, you know, the whole pragmatic school, simply because you don't have that theistic worldview. I'm with you. I've got a Christian worldview myself, and I agree that it's horrible, but it's not beyond understanding, really.
No, not at all. And, boy, I'm glad for an informed listener ready to cite Peter Singer and others as examples. Thank you for your call, Claire. You know, that's why I ended my article today with this sentence. Indeed, worldviews are a matter of life and death. It gets back to exactly what Claire is talking about here. In order to look at a proposal like this, you have to say, in what worldview would such a proposal be plausible? A proposal for suicide is a wonderful human possibility, or a proposal for abortion as a good, beneficial, fact-based, rational decision, not a tragedy. The worldview that would make such proposals plausible is one in which we cannot believe that human beings are made in the image of God. We cannot believe that every single human being from conception until natural death is the possessor of a gift of life from the Creator, who alone has the right to define and to begin and to end that life. There are things we know that cannot be present in that worldview that are essential to the Christian worldview. And thus we see why worldviews matter. If your worldview holds that human beings are nothing more than naturalistic accidents, if your worldview holds that the human being has potential dignity, that's where Peter Singer is, as Claire cited him. Peter Singer doesn't deny all human dignity. He just insists that human dignity is acquired. The human beings have to reach certain hallmarks. They have to possess certain capacities in order to be recognized as possessing dignity. Thus, Peter Singer goes so far as to say he not only supports abortion, but infanticide, because even human infants have not yet proved their dignity. They have not yet achieved the ability to use language, to relate, to conceive a future. Things which, by the way, he cites. Peter Singer goes so far as to argue that there are sentient pigs, that there are animals that have more dignity than human infants because they have greater capacities. And again, that gets to the fact that he doesn't believe that human beings are made in the image of God. And let's recall, dear listeners, that the Christian worldview, the biblical worldview, does not say that humans in general are made in the image of God. The Bible says that every single human being is made in the image of God. It is not merely an ascriptive capacity or reality that we generalize to humanity writ large. It is true of every single human being, or it's not true of any. I appreciate Claire's point so very much. That's why I entitled my article, Marvelous Suicide and Beneficial Abortion: Worldviews Matter. You know, whether it's abortion, or for that matter, issues related to human sexuality, or matters related to any of the great moral crises of our day, it all comes down to worldview, because human beings, oddly enough, are incredibly consistent even when they do not mean to be. If you start from a premise that we are biological accidents, that there is no creator and there is no God to define who shall live and who shall die, then it will eventually make sense to use an economic calculus to say, this one should live, that one should die. Or a eugenic calculus to say, this one's healthier, that one's sicker, we'll go with this one. Back with final thoughts. I'm Albert Moeller. Welcome back to the Albert Miller Program. We have time for one final caller calling from State College, Pennsylvania. Michael's listening on WTLR. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, Dr. Moeller, I understand they're drawing, you know, right now they're saying it's okay to kill the babies, abortion, and the elderly. But, you know, at what point, at what ages, you know, do they draw the line? And when they do decide to draw that line, what is their argument going to be?
Yeah,
I understand that.
Michael, oh, boy, that's just an excellent point. And again, if you're dealing with the Christian worldview, the distinctions are clear. If you're dealing with some kind of worldview that would make this plausible, the distinctions you're talking about have to be purely arbitrary, to which we would say, we're going to draw the line here. Why do you draw the line there? Well, because this is where we draw the line. we're going to say that persons with this capacity or persons lacking that capacity or persons in this condition or in another condition will live or will die. You know, your point is so well taken, Michael, because where you end up with this is, for instance, where it was in the shift from Weimar Germany. We have a very clear historical reference to your point. The shift from Weimar Germany, that was the very liberal democratic experiment that took place in Germany between the two world wars, and then the rise of Nazism. The idea of, in the German, it's Lebens und Wertensleben, or life unworthy of life, very key to our conversation today. That German concept of life unworthy of life was developed by doctors. And it was developed by doctors before the rise of the Third Reich. It was developed by doctors in Weimar Germany who came up with the idea that we should simply understand that there are some people who don't deserve to live. It's life unworthy of life. The profoundly mentally retarded, they put on that list. Those who had profound birth defects, they would put on that list. They would put others on that list, perhaps to the end stage of life. I'm more familiar with what they did in terms of the beginning stages of life. But when the Third Reich came into power, the Lebens und Wertensleben's doctrine of Weimar Germany was just there for the taking. And the Weimar doctors had drawn some arbitrary lines, and that's your point, Michael. They had said, we're going to stop here. But as you know, as soon as the Nazis got into total power and moved towards the final solution after the Wannsee Conference, it was the very same logic. The Jews are Lebens und Wertensleben's. The homosexuals are Lebens und Wertensleben's. The gypsies are Lebens und Wertensleben's. You know, that list goes on until people reach, well, probably what's really close to home. You know, the fact is that we are not given any authority to define who shall live and who shall die. We're given no authority to define who has human dignity and who does not, what life is worthy and what life is not. The Christian worldview begins with the fact that every single human being is made in the image of God, and thus every single human being has dignity and deserves to live. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with the Albert Mueller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmueller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmueller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.